ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
So today we're reading from we're starting the second chapter the first canto of Bhagavatam. So I'll just recite the first verse and text, and then we'll sing. So, text number one. Vyasa uvacha iti sam prashna samhrishto vipranam brahmaharshin prati pujya vachastesham pravaktu upachakrame. Ugra Shrava Suta Goswami, the son of Brahmaharshina, being fully satisfied by the perfect questions of the Brahmanas, thanked them and thus attempted to reply. Purport. The sages of Naimisharanya asked Suta Goswami 6 questions, and so he is answering them one by one. Okay, and now text number 2. Yam pravrajanta manupeta mapeta krityam.
Yam pravrajanta manupeta mapeta krityam.
Dvaipaya no vida hakatara ajuhu. Ajuhava.
Vaipaya no vida hakatara ajuhava.
Udreti tan mayataya taravo binedu.
Udreti tan mayataya taravo binedu.
Tam sarva bhuta hridayamunim anatosmi.
Tam sarva bhuta hridayamunim anatosmi.
Sutta, Sutta Goswami. Uvacha said, Yam, whom, Prabhajantam, while going away for the renounced order of life, Anuketam, without being reformed by the sacred bread, Aketa, not undergoing ceremonies, Kritam, prescribed duties, Vaipayana, Vyasade, Virava, separation, Katara, being afraid of, Ajuhava, explained, Putra iti, O my son, Kat Mayataya, being absorbed in that way. Parava, all the trees. Abhinedu, respondent, come unto him. Sarva, all. Bhuta, living entities. Kriyayam, heart. Muni, sage. Anata, asmi, upper basis. Srila Suta Goswami said, let me offer my respectful obeisances unto that great sage, Shukadeva Goswami, who can enter the hearts of all. When he went away to take up the renounced order of life, sannyas, leaving home without undergoing reformation by the sacred thread or the ceremonies observed by the higher castes, his father, Vyasadeva, fearing separation from him, cried out, Oh, my son! Indeed, only the trees, which were absorbed in the same feelings of separation, echoed in response to the bereaved father. Purport. Who would like to start reading? We have 3 paragraphs. Maybe we don't have mics. Okay.
The institution of Varna and Ashrama describes many regulated duties to be observed by its followers. Such duties enjoin that a candidate willing to study the Vedas must approach a bona fide spiritual master and request acceptance as his disciple. The sacred thread is the sign of those who are competent to study the Vedas from the Acharya or the bona fide spiritual master. Sri Shukadeva Goswami did not undergo such purgatory ceremonies because he was a liberated soul from his very birth. Generally, a man is born as an ordinary being, and by the purificatory processes, he is born for the second time. When he sees a new light and seeks direction for spiritual progress, he approaches a spiritual master for instruction in the Vedas. The spiritual master accepts only the sincere inquirer as his disciple and gives him the sacred thread. In this way, a man becomes twice born a dvija. After qualifying as a dvija, one may study the Vedas, and after becoming well versed in Vedas, one becomes a vipra. A vipra or a qualified brahmana thus realizes the absolute and makes further progress in spiritual life until he reaches the Vaishnava stage. Vaishnava stage is the postgraduate status of a brahmana. A progressive Brahmana must necessarily become a Vaishnava. For a Vaishnava is a self-realized, learned Brahmana.
Now, can you read the last paragraph?
Srila Shukadeva Goswami was a Vaishnava from the beginning. Therefore, there was no need for him to undergo all the processes of the Varnashram institution. Ultimately, the aim of Varnashram Dharma is to turn a crude man into a pure devotee of the Lord, or Vaishnava. Anyone, therefore, who becomes a Vaishnava, accepted by the first class Vaishnava, or Uttama Adhikari Vaishnava, is already considered a Brahmana, regardless of his birth or past deeds. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted this principle and recognized Srila Haridas Thakur as the Acharya of the Holy Name, although Thakur Haridas appeared in a Mohammedan family. In conclusion, Srila Shukadeva Goswami was born a Vaishnava, and therefore Brahmanism was included in him. He did not have to undergo any ceremonies. Any low-born person, be he a Kirata, Puna, Andhra, Galinda, Vilaksha, Avira, Shumba, Yavana, Khasa, or even lower, can be delivered to the highest transcendental position by the mercy of Vaishnavas. Srila Shukadeva Goswami was the spiritual master of Sri Sukta Goswami, who therefore offers his respectful obeisances unto Srila Shukadeva Goswami before he begins his answers to the questions of the sages at Naimisharanya.
Om Agyanatimirandasya Gyanam Jana Shakaya Shakshur Umyalitam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha. So this is a very nice purport, and it really exemplifies the mood that Srila Prabhupada had. So what happened 52 years ago?
Srila Prabhupada arrived in America.
Yeah. So today's the lunar day. So he actually arrived on the 17th of September, but on the lunar calendar, today's the day. So I was just thinking it's a very appropriate verse for Prabhupada's arrival, because he came in a time where, well, when he was coming here, he didn't know who he was going to meet, and he didn't know if they would even want to hear the message. So I'm going to share with you a little bit about what he wrote in a poem when he arrived in Boston. He wrote this poem in Bengali, and maybe on the 17th he'll sing it. Probably will sing it. Read it. So he says, "My dear Lord Krishna, you're so kind upon this useless soul, but I do not know why you have brought me here. Now you can do whatever you like with me. But I guess you have some business here, otherwise why would you bring me to this terrible place?" So he's actually not even gotten off the ship yet. He's still in the harbor, and he can already feel the energies in the place. "Most of the population here is covered by the material modes of ignorance and passion. Absorbed in material life, they think themselves very happy and satisfied. Therefore, they have no taste for the transcendental message of Vasudeva. I do not know how they will be able to understand it." And then he goes into, it's a long one, so I'll skip ahead. He describes, you know, the condition of the living entities, how they're kind of controlled by material energy. And "how will I make them understand this message of Krishna consciousness? I'm very unfortunate, unqualified, and the most fallen. Therefore, I'm seeking your benediction so that I can convince them, for I am powerless to do so on my own. Somehow or other, O Lord, you have brought me here to speak about you. Now, my Lord, it is up to you to make me a success or failure as you like. O spiritual master of all the worlds," and who is he speaking about? Who is he speaking to?
Chaitanya.
Yeah, Krishna or Lord Chaitanya, yeah. "I can simply repeat your message. So if you, like you, can make..." There might be a little typo in this. "So you can make my power of speaking suitable." So if you like, you can make my power of speaking suitable for their understanding. "Only by your causeless mercy will my words become pure. I am sure that when this transcendental message penetrates their hearts, they will certainly feel gladdened and thus become liberated from all unhappy conditions of life." And then he says the famous verse. What does he say next?
"Make me dance."
Yes. What does he say?
"Make me dance as you wish."
Yeah. So like a
puppet.
Like a puppet, yeah. "Oh Lord, I'm just like a puppet in your hands. So if you have brought me here to dance, then make me dance. Oh Lord, make me dance as you like." When I was growing up, there was a song. I don't know if you remember that. One devotee had recorded this. "Make me dance like a puppet." And so it's like in my mind. "I have no devotion, nor do I have any knowledge, but I have strong faith in the holy name of Krishna. I have been designated as Bhakti Vedanta, And now, if you like, you can fulfill the real purport of Bhakti Vedanta. So it fits completely in with this purport of where we hear that any low-born person can be elevated to the status of a Brahmin just by the mercy and association of a great devotee. So particularly this sentence, anyone who becomes a Vaishnava accepted by the first class Vaishnava, or Uttama Adhikari. So an Uttama Adhikari is a person, is a Vaishnava who doesn't see with distinction. He sees with equal vision all the living entities and actually has a very compassionate outlook on life. So person who is accepted by that devotee, of Uttama Adhikari, is already considered a Brahmana regardless of his birth or past deeds. And then, of course, Haridas Thakur, which Sesha Prabhu, he spoke about. So there are a lot of interesting things that we could discuss with this purport. I was thinking that we could discuss the difference between Brahmins and Vaishnavas, or the similarities, like how they fit together. And Prabhupada, when Prabhupada was a child, he had a lot of Brahmins visiting his home when he was growing up. His father would invite them over, sadhus, Brahmins, they would come and eat. And when he was older, he was a little skeptical about the people, about Brahmins and about sadhus. Like, he didn't write off... He was skeptical because the position of Brahmana had been so misused, and he had seen it being misused, like people wanting money and making it ritualistic and all that. So when his friend, when he was in college, his friend said, come see the sadhu with me. Like, he's a really great, great devotee. Prabhupada was a little hesitant at first because he thought it was going to be another person like that. So on the one hand, Prabhupada himself was a little, he wasn't very tolerant for the fake Brahmins, the fake sadhus. And he actually, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he really gets really heavy about people misusing that kind of, people in India especially, where they misuse that, and they consider that nobody can be a Vaishnava except if you're a Brahmin, like by birth. So that was on one hand, but then the other hand, Prabhupada came to create this movement, and he wanted this movement to be, what did he want this movement to be? I didn't ask the question, but he basically created a... Yes?
Well, late kirtans, I'm sorry.
What?
We're spaced out here a lot of late kirtans.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I was actually wanted to ask, who's here tired? Who here is tired? Yeah, long nights. He created a movement where he wanted this movement to be like the Brahmin head of society, like a place where people could come and ask us questions and get advice, like how Brahmins were. So really what we're looking at here is not the title Brahmin, but the quality Brahmin. That's what we're really discussing here. Because there's a difference. The people in India who have the title Brahmin, then they might define themselves by how they were born into a Brahmin lineage and all that, and that's different than what Prabhupada wanted to set up, which was the qualities of a Brahmin. So, there's a verse in Bhagavad Gita, 1842. Does anybody know that verse? 1842. It's the qualities of the Brahmin.
Sma dhamat va socham chantir arjula mevacham jnanam vijnanam astikyam brahma karmam sambhavacham. Truthfulness, cleanliness, austerity, peacefulness, knowledge, realization. These are the qualities by which a Brahmin was.
Yeah, okay. So, truthfulness. So there's also peace. Okay, I'll read the translation here. Peacefulness, self-control, austerity, purity, tolerance, honesty, wisdom, knowledge, and religiousness, and good memory. these are the qualities by which the brahmanas work. So this is what we're talking about. We're talking about a brahminical person. A devotee is automatically elevated to the level of a Brahmin. We're speaking about how Vaishnava automatically has these qualities. What other qualities can you think of when you think of what would make the quality of a Brahmin besides what we read here?
Compassionate. I don't know.
Compassionate. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Broad-mindedness.
Broad-mindedness, uh-huh.
Friendly.
Friendly. Friendly with living entities, yeah, that's a big one. Mm-hmm.
Responsible.
Responsible.
Tolerant and open-minded.
Open-minded and tolerant, yeah. With others, mm-hmm. Yeah, meeting others. So these are qualities that a Brahmin, an ideal Brahmin would have, or a person of brahminical nature qualities. So can you think of some Brahmins? What we're gonna do is talk about Brahmins and then what makes a Vaishnava different than a Brahmin. Like, so I was trying to think of a Venn diagram that would work for this. So because I like to see how things fit together. So if you had like a circle with Vaishnavas, and there's different ways you could do this, but Brahmin's nature would be within that, so that's what Prabhupada's saying. Automatically, a devotee has the qualities of a Brahmin. But then there's also Brahmins who aren't in that, who aren't Vaishnavas necessarily. Because earlier Prabhupada says, the Vaishnava stage is the postgraduate status of a Brahmin. So someone might be a Brahmin, but not, might have brahminical tendencies, qualities, nature, but not necessarily have reached the level of a Vaishnava. So can you think of examples in our Western society history of people that might fall into that category? Yes. So the question is, can you think of people who are considered brahmanas, that we know as being brahmanas, whether it's the Western society or Indian, you know, the scriptures, but who's not necessarily a Vaishnava? Or not fully a Vaishnava, yes?
In fact, we have so many intellectuals in the Western society who might even study the Bhagavatam or so forth, and they might themselves be in the mode of goodness.
Yeah.
So in some ways, they have some knowledge. A lot of people in the mode of goodness, but they don't have any Vaishnava quality.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So there's like a kind of a gray or a scale. It's not so black and white. It's like you can see a person who is a Brahmin but might also have some tendencies towards a Vaishnava or you know, that. But then there might be a Brahmin who's really arrogant, who's not really. You can see the different natures. Yeah.
Well, we probably all of us probably met some Brahmanas, but they're not really Brahmanas because they don't have the qualities of a Brahman. So like, I had a friend, like a Russian friend, and he told me that he met Brahmanas and they're smoking, drinking, eating meat, and probably even gambling, and they're considered Brahmanas because by birth their parents are Brahmanas, but they don't know anything about, you know, about following any scriptures or anything. They're just another, you know, like, I guess, materialist.
So that's more of the kind of the caste lineage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about the qualities that we mentioned earlier of a Brahmin? Where can you see that? Tell us your
idea. Like amongst and other religions, like Catholic priests or nuns, like that, people that live very simple, austere lives, devoted to God, but don't necessarily know that God is fluent.
Yeah. So that would be kind of in between because they're definitely worshippers of God. So they're, but they might not have the full extent of Vaishnava knowledge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In East Asian tradition, I can think of Confucius. He was really Brahminical in terms of his teachings and his intellect. But he wasn't devotee of God, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Sukracharya and Vrishpati, the priests of the demigods and the demons, but they're not, you know, but they're more like focused on the impersonal aspect.
Yeah, that's a big thing. Yeah, impersonalism versus personalism, too. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yes.
Well, in the West, of course, we have Socrates. In fact, the professor at Yale, who was the one of the experts on Socrates, wrote an article called Socrates as a Sadhu.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He had a lot of brahminical qualities. He was understood philosophy, understood there was a supreme, and same thing Plato, Aristotle.
Yeah. I actually was thinking about Socrates because I was just reading about him. He was a very pious person, very humble and introspective and wanted to share his knowledge with others. So those qualities of a Brahmin. And he also said the unexamined life is
not worth living.
Yes. So he was very much of that, thinking we have to examine our lives, have to understand where we're coming from and where we're going. Yes?
Well,
Well, Brahmana, we can understand that there's four classes in human orders in human society, and we can understand that those who work as Brahmanas, even though they don't even know the word Brahmana,
yeah,
they're acting as Brahmanas. For example, here in Gainesville, at the UF across the street, there's thousands of them who are professors.
Yes.
And, you know, and are misleading their students by what they're teaching them. So those would be, they have all their qualities. They eat meat, they smoke, they drink everything. But they're, and they, although they're acting as teachers, they're really false Brahmanas.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. There's also a variety, there's, I guess the main thing is that it's very important not to, we can't know just from the externals whether someone's a Brahmin or not, or how they're living their lives, right? So there might be a variety of different kinds of people, like for example, the professors on campus. There might be some who actually are very genuinely pious and offering nice, you know, information, and then others who are doing a double life. And so it is difficult to know right offhand how someone's living, but I wanted to kind of see, just talking about the basic idea of a Brahmin and see what do Vaishnavas have on top of that that includes the Brahminical qualities, but beyond that, what do they have beyond? Yeah.
I was thinking of the wives of the Brahmins, the yajnik Brahmins, who do all the rituals, but their wives actually had love for Krishna.
Mm.
So they were Brahminis by caste. But unlike their husbands, they were Vaishnavas.
Yeah, yes. So love for Krishna, love for, yeah, for, yes.
The Vaishnavas, they all know about Krishna or about God.
Yeah.
And he's the center of their lives, and they have dedicated their lives to his service.
Yeah.
Be the difference.
Yes, and the personalism that Rupachandra mentioned too, impersonal versus personal, yes.
Also, for the Vaishnavas, sometimes for the Brahmanas, the details can be really the important thing.
Yeah.
It's the yajna, it's the rituals, it's the timing, and you know all those little details.
Yeah.
It's make or break one's spirituality. And for the Vaishnavas, according to Rupa Goswami, our highest principle is always remembering Krishna, never forgetting Krishna. And so the details are subservient to that principle.
Mm.
So we, a lot of focus in our Vaishnava philosophy of our Vaishnavas is on the main principles and not so much on the details.
Really good point, yes. Mm-hmm. So less ritualistic, more what's the deeper purpose behind them. Yeah.
Kind of similar to what Shruti was saying, kind of when I think of like the difference between the Brahmins and their wives and that pastime, is like that this desire to serve Krishna and please Krishna becomes more important than the details of the rituals.
Mm.
Even though they're aware of all those details, they know how to do them, they know all the externals, but some, for a Vaishnava, sometimes that desire to serve and please Krishna can overpower or like overshadow all these little things, you know, that like need to be done according to every
prescription. Yeah. Yeah, good point. It kind of
Brahmanas tend to become pretty proud.
Mm. That's a really good point, yeah. Humility is a really big possible distinguishing factor. Some Brahmins are humble, of course. But there's a tendency when you don't offer your talents to Krishna that you can become arrogant about them, like pride. So that's one I had written down too. Like the two that I thought of that are very different, big differences, is surrender to Krishna and humility. Those two, and then all the things that you mentioned. So in 1911, there was an event that happened in Bengal. There was a big assembly and the topic was Brahmanas and Vaishnavas, and trying to reconcile. It was actually a debate held between different speakers about who is actually superior, and or is it possible for a Brahmana or a non-Brahmana to be a Vaishnava? That was really the gist of it, because the Brahmins were jealous or envious of the Vaishnavas that were actually not from Brahminical background. So does anybody want to tell that story of how Bhaktisiddhanta, Abhi, do you know it?
Not well enough.
Okay. So anybody else want to share that story?
You just read it recently.
You did?
Uh-huh. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was invited to speak,
yeah,
and he was ill, so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, his son, went on his behalf. He was in the midst of his vow of chanting a billion names when this took place.
Mm-hmm.
But he went for the presentation, and he began by speaking about how great the Brahmins are. So all the Brahmins present were pleased. But then he explained these differences between the Brahmin and the Vaishnava, how the Vaishnava is superior, and very conclusively.
Yeah.
So people appreciated it and accepted his conclusion. The Brahmins were defeated publicly. So that built his reputation as a speaker and scholar.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was one more detail that that I had just read, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he actually, he didn't go under the excuse of being sick, or he gave the excuse of being ill to not go, but really the reason he didn't go is because his Diksha Guru was there.
Oh.
And his Diksha Guru, Bipin Bihari Goswami, so he's not the one at the altar, so the Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Diksha Guru was not the person he actually sought out most of his instruction from, who was Jagannath Das Babaji. But his Diksha Guru was there and was going to actually refute the fact that people who are from non-Brahmin families could be Vaishnavas. So he didn't want to get into battle with that, and that's why he asked, that's why he said, oh, I'm ill, and he asked his son to go. So, yeah, that was the etiquette. So the Bhaktisiddhanta was really made, when he was first glorifying the Brahmins, all the Brahmins in the audience were getting excited. They thought he was, because he started with the Brahmins, like, glorifying their position, and then they all thought, oh yeah, he's supporting us, and then they realized when he said, actually, Lord Chaitanya gave us this verse that whether you're Shudra or a sannyasi, you can become, you're qualified as a guru if you understand the, if you worship Krishna, if you're a devotee of Krishna. So that goes beyond Brahman. And then everyone got really mad, and yeah, so. There's another interesting thing I read recently to describe what a Vaishnava, the character of a Vaishnava, and I read it in this book, Black Lotus. Does anybody know, read this book? So it's the biography of Bhakti Tirtha Swami. Who here knows Bhakti Tirtha Swami? Okay. Uh-huh. So maybe half. Okay. So he's a great devotee who passed away in 2005. And he was a guru, sannyasi, and he traveled the world. And this whole book's really nice. It's an amazing story. So when he was leaving the planet, he actually, sometimes you can tell the character of a person best when they're leaving the planet. Like, you can really see the qualities of a Vaishnava by how they pass away. So this is an excerpt from the book, and I thought we could do it. He does a little, you'll see, I'll show you. So this is a quote from Sangeeta Dasi. Does anybody here know Sangeeta? Yeah. So she's the one who started Vaishnava's Care, which is for terminally ill devotees. And so she was going to Gitanagari. Bhakti Tirtha Swami was in Gitanagari when he was leaving his body. And she was going there every once in a while to make sure he was getting the right medication or taking care of some of his arrangements. And so she wrote this quote, or this excerpt here. During my visits to Gitanagari Farm, I watched in awe as he used his last bit of strength and energy to teach others about what he was experiencing. Every Sunday, he willingly accepted much personal discomfort to travel from his house down a rocky road in order to give class to the large crowd of devotees who assembled weekly in the temple room. He began each class with a kirtan, and within minutes, his voice would choke up and tears would flow from his eyes as he sang the holy names of Radha Damodar, the presiding deities in Gitanagari. Watching him, I couldn't imagine the level of intense physical pain he was feeling. But, like the spiritual warrior he was, he simply tolerated it in order to speak one more time to his devoted disciples and loving God brothers and God sisters. Spiritual warrior is in a double meaning there, because he wrote a series of books called Spiritual Warrior. So that's why she's referring to him as a spiritual warrior. Just as Maharaj lived his entire life thinking about the welfare of others, he spent his last days in the same mood. He never cared for himself or the pain it would bring him to give yet another dynamic lecture that touched the hearts of all who were present. And then this is the part that I wanted to do with everybody here. The one class that stands out the most in my memory, and I'm simply paraphrasing this, is when he asked for a show of hands from everyone who had ever suffered in any way and had asked, why me, why not someone else? So let's do this exercise. And you don't have to participate if you don't want to, but it's just to give a really good idea. He's gonna ask three questions. So first question is, who here has ever suffered and asked, why me, why not someone else? I have, for sure. He then asked for a raise of hands from those who had ever watched another's suffering and thought, I'm glad it's not me. Finally, he asked, who in the room had ever watched another's pain and suffering and thought, why them, why not me? This is the mood of a Vaishnava. That really touched me because I was just thinking about that, like how I've never thought that. Like, I've never really thought, oh, I wish I could take on their suffering for them. Like, that's not something that comes naturally to me. And that's exactly the mood of a Vaishnava at their pinnacle, is like wanting to take everybody else's pain so that they can get better in spiritual life, and I'll take their suffering on. Yes, Sri.
After my career, I've thought, why them? That's it.
Why them? Yeah.
Almost.
Half enough. Yeah. So that the mood, actually, in the last chapter, it's called A Long Journey Home. He had cancer, and it was about a year of his decline. And he mentioned Vasudev Dutt several times. Does anybody here not know who Vasudev Dutt is? Okay, so Vasudev Dutt was an associate of Lord Chaitanya, and he was really compassionate. He asked Lord Chaitanya, can I please take on everybody's suffering in the whole world and so that they can go back to Krishna, and I'll just stay here for however long as it takes to burn off all their karma. That kind of mood. And so that was the mood. Vasudev Dutt is his name. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the ultimate Vaishnava mood. And that's what he was getting to when he asked that third question. And then another example of Vaishnava qualities is in the Six Goswamis. There's a nice song for them. And the first verse says, I offer my respectful obeisances unto the Six Goswamis, Rupa, Sanatan, Raghunath, Raghunath Das Goswami, Raghunath Bhatta, Sri Jiva, and Sri Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who are always engaged in chanting the holy name of Krishna and dancing. So you can see how this is beyond the Brahmin level. This goes way beyond. They're fully absorbed in Krishna. They're just like the ocean of love of God, and they are popular both with the gentle and with the ruffians, because they are not envious of anyone. And the person who wrote this, Srinivas Acharya, actually had their association. So he's speaking, he's describing how he experienced them. So they're popular both with the gentle and with the ruffians, because they're not envious of anyone. Whatever they do, they are all pleasing to everyone, and they are fully blessed by Lord Chaitanya. Thus, they are engaged in missionary activities meant to deliver all the conditioned souls in the material universe. So do you see a pattern there with all the descriptions of the Vaishnavas? Going back to the beginning of the class with Prabhupada coming to the West and feeling the same way, like, I want to share this so much with everybody, but I'm not sure how they're going to receive it. That's the same mood that he's describing in the Six Goswamis, that they wanted to deliver all the conditioned souls in the world. So that generous, generous mood. Any other examples or thoughts or questions on that? Yeah.
I was thinking on the Ramana, is the little boy that was Maharaj Parikshit Srini. Ramana.
So another example of is Sringi, the boy who cursed Parikshit. So he was an example of somebody who was a Brahmin, considered a Brahmin boy, but maybe didn't act like the true qualities of Vaishnava. That was part of the pastime, but he got very angry, and one of the qualities of a Brahmin is tolerance. So, yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to say anything more because I think I've already talked enough, but one thing I just raised, you made it the example of Maharaj Blank Sannyasi. Seems I'm bad with names. Again, his name.
Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj.
And we all saw, every one of us in this room probably, Srila Prabhupada in his last moments, because probably everybody here saw the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes? So Do you remember that Parisari, Prabhupada's secretary and servant, said that right even 2 weeks before Prabhupada passed from this world, he was still translating. And we saw Prabhupada sitting in the night and struggling to translate the Srimad Bhagavatam and make his commentaries. And you could hear in his voice that he was struggling. And then there was even a scene where Prabhupada was laying on his bed just within hours before leaving his body. And his mission to give us Srimad Bhagavatam, these books of transcendental knowledge, and one devotee was holding the microphone to Prabhupada's mouth, and he was speaking his translations and per voice right there. So I think that's even a greater example. Srila Prabhupada is our founder Acharya.
Yeah, and it's a perfect example of how he actually worked, or he spiritually worked all the way until the end. He didn't. He died on the battlefield, so to speak, of spiritually wanting to help everybody. Yeah, through his purports. And so yeah, it's actually very touching. If anybody hasn't seen that, it's very heavy, but a touching to see the video of Prabhupada leaving his body. Thank you for sharing that. It's really, really nice. Yeah. Another quote, another little thing about Prabhupada when he was in Vrindavan. In the early days, some of his disciples were visiting temples, and the local Brahmin said to them, if you're so fortunate in your next life, you'll take birth as Brahmanas here, you know, in Vrindavan. And they went back and told Prabhupada that they hadn't responded. They didn't say anything in response, and Prabhupada said, oh, you should go back right now and tell them that if they're so fortunate in their next life, they'll take birth in ISKCON. So, yeah. There are many examples also of devotees who weren't in the Brahmin category, but became really exalted. For example, the hunter Murari, he got the association of Nardini, and he became a great devotee. Or the cobbler and the Brahmana. So there was one, I'll quickly say the story. Nardamuni was traveling around, and he came across a Brahmin, and the Brahmin said, when you see Vishnu next time, or Narayan next time, can you ask him when I'm going to get liberation? When's my time? And so Narada said, okay, I will. Then he came across a cobbler who was doing his shoe work. And the cobbler asked the same question, just curious when he would be able to see the Lord after, you know, like when in the upcoming time. So then Narada Muni went back to, this is a story that Prabhupada's told in one of his lectures. So Narada Muni went back to Vaikuntha, and he asked these questions to Narayan, Lord Narayan. And Lord Narayan said, well, the Brahmin's actually going to, it's going to take him a while, not even sure when, Prabhupada says it like this, I'm not even sure when the Brahmin's going to come back to me. It's going to take him many lifetimes. But the cobbler, he's going to come back to me at the end of this life. So you can go back and tell them that. And if they ask what I was doing when you came to visit me, you can tell them that I was putting an elephant through the eye of a needle. And so Narada Muni went back and told them. The Brahmana got furious. He said, what? I've been doing all these, you know, these rituals and these activities and all the everything proper. Why would it take, I don't get it. So he was very upset. And he said, well, what was he doing anyway when you got there? And Narada Muni said, well, he was actually putting an elephant through the eye of a needle. And then the Brahmin's faith, you could see the quality of it wasn't there, because he immediately said, no way, that's ridiculous. You're just playing around with me. So then he dismissed the whole thing. Then when he went to the cobbler, Narada Muni told him the same story. The cobbler was overjoyed, and he was actually, he couldn't believe that he was going to go see Krishna in his next, like at the end of this life. He felt like he wasn't qualified. He felt like, how is it possible? So he was the opposite. He was totally humble. And then when he told him the story about the elephant and the needle, and the cobbler said, oh, wow, that's amazing. My Lord's amazing. And Narada said, aren't you a little bit, doesn't it surprise you? And Cobb said, no. And do you know what example he gave? Why? Yes.
The seed and the trees coming from the seed. If Krishna is able to put a tree inside a small seed, why wouldn't he be able to put an elephant through it?
Yeah. So if he can do it right here, we see it all around us, little acorns, and they have a tree, like, blueprint of a tree in them. They're going to grow into a tree. So he wasn't surprised. So that story is a really good example of the difference between a Brahmin and a Vaishnava, just from externals. Yes, Rupa Chandra?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So what happens, like, sometimes you see people of Brahmini coat,
they're humble, they're honest, they're truthful, they're broad-minded. And sometimes you see devotees who are maybe dishonest, or maybe a little fanatical, and maybe the behavior is not very pleasing. So then who is...
there's a category for each, like... there's a way to put each, there's a different kind of group for each one. There's like the Brahmins who aren't really Brahmins, the Brahmins who are really Brahmins, the Vaishnavas who are not, you know, like that. But who would like to answer that question? Would one of you?
Yeah.
Not the mic.
Give me the microphone.
This is from... this is from the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam. It's Prahlad pacifying Lord and Sringadeva with prayers. He says, if a Brahmana has all 12 of the Brahminical qualifications, as they are stated in the book called Sanat Sujata, but is not a devotee and is averse to the lotus feet of the Lord, he is certainly lower than a devotee who is a dog eater, who has dedicated everything, mind, words, activities, wealth, and life, to the Supreme Lord. Such a devotee is better than such a Brahmana, because the devotee can purify his whole family, whereas the so-called Brahmana, in a position of false prestige, cannot purify even himself. Mm. So it seems to kind of answer that question, even if they're a dog eater, so that means they're eating meat and the lowest.
Wow. Yeah. Some of those verses are a little hard for me to understand because, there is a switch. Oh, the red one. Yes.
Is that verse pertaining to a person born in a dog eater family or a person who's actually a dog?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never heard that verse before.
It says, well, Prabhupada translates it, one born in a low family or a dog eater. And the actual Sanskrit is pacham, which means, according to my guru, pacha means to cook. So it literally means dog cooker. So like those verses that say, one is, you know, even born in a family of dogs, it's like they cook and eat dogs. So
well, at least you're not eating it raw.
So it seems to be that they're referring to literally one who cooks dogs.
Yeah. One thought that I had is that we have to be really careful not to judge others so much as we work on ourselves. So as a Vaishnav, as a practitioner of this Vaishnav philosophy, we should really focus on, Prabhupada really wanted each one of us to become that example of like an ideal person. Therefore, there won't be a population of people that you're mentioning of like who are pretend to be Vaishnavas but aren't really, because we would all be working on improving ourselves. And Prabhupada actually, when he was in India especially, he wanted his disciples, he was really stressed this point, to be gentlemanly, ladylike, to be really portraying that ideal Brahminical culture so that other people wouldn't criticize us, wouldn't criticize the devotees for that exact reason. So, yeah.
Just two things. Raghunath Das Goswami talks about attaining the higher levels of Vaishnavism in his book Manak Shiksha.
Yeah.
And he describes the donkey urine that saturates the Vaishnava who is still contaminated with pride.
Mm-hmm.
And how that manifests in different ways. So
it was hypocrisy. It's an analogous for hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy.
Yeah.
When a Vaishnava is still holding on to that, then it's compared to that he's externally doing Vaishnava activities, but is that if your heart is still burning inside, that's a sign that you're doing either somehow or other.
Yeah, and if we think that we're, oh, here I am, I'm a Vaishnava, better than you,
yes,
then automatically that's what we're doing. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And just quickly, Prabhupada gave a talk once about the four classes to a skeptical French audience, and then afterwards one of the students said, so what class are you? And Prabhupada immediately said, I'm fifth class, I'm servant of all the other classes.
Sometimes it gets bewildering how we see Vaishnavas may not have, as the question was asked, the qualities that we'd like to see. And sometimes Brahmins who aren't Vaishnavas may be cleaner or whatever quality. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the process of devotional service of Rupa Goswami describes. We've got to pull, as we're watering the creeper devotional service, we're also watering the weeds.
Yeah.
So we're simultaneously doing both. And if we're not constantly pulling the weeds, the pride, as Kalakant was saying, can grab us. And because we always have the existential freedom. It's not that we can do any set of rituals and be liberated, be the Vaishnava rituals, Brahmin rituals. None of that's going to take us there. We always completely have the freedom, because if we don't have the freedom, the existential freedom, then there's no such thing as opening our heart up to love and the ultimate relationship between ourselves and the Supreme. It's not there without that freedom. And that freedom means we can inadvertently water the creeper. Now, the good news is, it's not all bad news. We water the creeper grows up, it's choking, the weeds are choking our devotional creeper. But as Krishna, Arjuna asks the same question, well, what happens if boy, we try and we don't succeed, or we like a riven cloud, is it all lost? No, as Prabhupada describes in Purport, it's not lost. The nice thing is, if you made 1%, you only have 99 to go. So if somebody fails on the devotional path, it's not lost, but something in their heart wasn't there. And we can't, if we force rituals to take us to the goal, then it doesn't change the heart. And without freedom, there's not love.
Well, thank you very much. It's time to end, right?
I just heard Arnold said this about, but basically my chief guru said that if he's not a Vaishnava, then we shouldn't, you know, learn anything from them, because they don't know, therefore they're in ignorance. So if they're not a Vaishnava, you know, it's not a Krishna, you know, like maybe a teacher, you know, like they're teaching right now like the theory of evolution, and they say, yeah, this is it. But they don't know, you know, like, so if they don't know, like, why should we listen to that, you know, that's nonsense. Yeah.
So it's important to have discretion when we're listening to people. But like I think Jesus Christ said, hate the sin and not the sinner. So if somebody's saying something, we can disagree with that, but we can still appreciate the person who's trying their best to share knowledge in the way they know, and we can still find good qualities in every person. That's how a devotee tries to see. So yeah, so both things. Yeah, Shruti.
Yeah, last one. There is a verse in the third canto when the four Kumaras first the two door keepers, and then the Vishnu comes and he says a few verses, and one of the verses he says is that anyone in Vrindavan will even down to the Chandala who lives by cooking and eating the flesh of the dog is immediately purified if he takes part in hearing through the ear and the glorification of my name, fame, etc. And then the Purport Prabhupada says that if a devotee, as long as a person is in this material world, he has two different relationships in his dealings with others. One relationship pertains to the body, and the other pertains to the spirit. As far as bodily affairs or social activities are concerned, although a person is purified on the spiritual platform, it is sometimes seen that he acts in terms of his bodily relationships. If a devotee born in the family of a chandala is sometimes found engaged in his habitual activities, he is not to be considered a chandala. In other words, the Vaishnava should not be evaluated in terms of his body.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Thank you.
There might be so many lingering habits that we don't judge devotees based on those little small things that are still there.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for taking part in this discussion. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.